Endless Hustle presented by the Movie Trivia Schmodown. The Movie Trivia Schmodown is the ultimate mental sport for the movie fanatic. Intense movie trivia with the flair of pro wrestling. Championship matches, competing factions. MTS has the best competitors in the world. This isn't your parents' game show. The end of the season finale is a Schmodown Spectacular Six. All of the championships on the line and all the greats play here. This isn't bar trivia, this is the Movie Trivia Schmodown.
I fought a good fight. I finished my football race. And after 18 years, it's time.
Basketball players, we're really supposed to shut up and dribble, but I'm glad we do a little bit more than that.
Eventually, every ball would go flat, but that doesn't mean that your life will flatline. What will you do when the game is over?
All right, Endless Hustlers, episode 114 of Bro Bible's Endless Hustle. Happy Thanksgiving. This episode should be landing on Thanksgiving, so have a happy and a healthy one to you and your family. If you're traveling, be safe. We've got a brand new episode to listen and watch that'll keep you company during your Thanksgiving travels. We've got the legend Stevie Van Zandt. Of course, you know Stevie from The Sopranos, Sill, the consigliere of all consigliaries. And of course, Bruce Springsteen, the E Street Band. He's got a brand new book out. It's called Unrequited Infatuations. Incredible. Read the book. What a life this guy's lived. Awesome, awesome chat. And then we have an incredible, incredible conversation with hip-hop legend Too Short. He's got a brand new song for the Oakland. It's Las Vegas Raiders. I'm still calling them the Oakland Raiders. Actually, they could still be the LA Raiders in my mind. But yeah, he's got a great new song with Ice Cube for the LA Raiders. And we're talking so much hip hop history. It's unreal. And the coolest thing is if you get to watch this, he literally did this while on the move because he was selling his car. One of the more unique interviews I've ever done. So let's kick this episode off. First up, Stevie Van Zandt, his brand new book is called Unrequited Infatuations. Great, great conversation. Enjoy. All right, we got a great day on the hustle. I'm joined by one of the greats, a man who has unrequited infatuations. I love, what a great book title right off the bat, Stevie Van Zandt. Congrats on the new book. I'm loving it. It's talking to your former co-star, Steve Sciarippa, earlier today. He said to say hello.
Oh, hello back to him.
Dude, writing this book, how cool is it to share your story with everyone?
It's a lot of fun. And that's right. Stevie and Michael have their own book out right now, right?
Yep.
The Sopranos book, which I'm looking forward to reading that. This was kind of interesting for me because I don't really look back very often, you know. So it was fun to kind of go back to the 60s for a minute, and really relive those days, because you know you gotta really transport yourself back, or else you're not gonna be able to communicate what that vibe was. You know, you wanna create the environment a little bit, you wanna create the context, you wanna share what you were thinking if you can you know imagine that, you know, and that's the way to I think, you know, the book will, you know, works best, you know, when you can do that.
You've had, when you talk about one of the most fascinating lives on the planet, you know, to be part of one of the greatest bands of all time with one of the greatest performers of all time, then you end up on arguably the greatest television show of all time. You ever kind of look back at this and you're like, shit, what just happened?
Well, yeah, it happens kind of slowly, you know what I mean? So you kind of, I guess you just kind of get used to it. I mean, in a way, you know, and most of the time it's not what you're planning on. So it becomes a little bit bizarre, even for me, you know, because, you know, you're planning all these things over here and your life comes in that back door. I mean, most of the time in my case, I mean, you know, there's only a couple of things I've actually planned. You know, I think my radio show was one of the few things I can think of where, you know, something I planned and ended up doing and ended up having some success with, you know, but mostly everything else was circumstance, you know, bizarre circumstance or, just, you know, luck, you know. So you're kind of floating through it. You know what I mean? You're kind of, I mean, I work very hard to live in the moment, you know. So you know, when these opportunities come up and you recognize them as an opportunity, you know, you wanna completely focus on that at that moment and really get the most out of it, you know, even though it might be something brand new or something you didn't expect. You know, you gotta be a little bit flexible in this life, you know, and just kind of okay, that's where destiny's taking me. Okay, let's make the most of it, you know.
Obviously, your second life, The Sopranos, you know, with the many saints of Newark, I call it the greatest show of on TV history. I grew up with it. Now, The Many Saints of Newark comes out. I was talking to Sharip about this today, and it essentially brings a whole new generation to The Sopranos universe. All the stories have been coming out. You were considered for Tony Soprano, then you land Syl, and it's incredible. But when people see you, is it like now, do you get more Syl or do you get more shit? He's the famous rock and roll star.
I don't know. It's kind of depends on what's going on at that time. You know, if you're touring at the time, obviously that's what's on people's minds. But during a quarantine, Sopranos made a huge comeback, and so did Lilyhammer, by the way. I think more people saw Lilyhammer during the quarantine than they saw it the first time around, because it was the first show on Netflix, which, you know, people didn't know what Netflix was when Lilyhammer came on. So it depends. You know, it depends on what's going on at that moment. But, you know, whatever part of my work people like, I'm fine with. You know,
as long as they don't kick you out of the restaurant.
That's right. You know, some people just know me as a DJ. They, you know, they just know me as a, you know, they might know me just as a radio guy. You know, who knows? But as long as they like something.
The bandana is almost as famous as you. How did the bandana start and why does it never come off?
Well, it came from a car accident I had coming back from the pony one night and smashed into the windshield, and my hair never grew in. You know, they had several operations and never really grew in right. So at that point, you know, I wasn't ready to start wearing wigs. And, you know, Bruce suggested, you know, I had been wearing a bandana every now and then just for fun. I don't know where that comes from. You know, maybe my obsession with Zorro as a kid or something. I don't know. But, you know, so it was something that Bruce suggested. And then so I started wearing bandanas, just it became my thing. And you know, it turned out to really come in handy when it comes to the acting thing, because you know, your big concern is, you know, you don't want people watching a Sopranos episode saying, "Oh, I just saw him playing in Cleveland last week." You know, that's your biggest fear. So you want to, you know, look as differently as you can look. And so the bandana allows me to be really different. And you know, whatever hair I have with that character, it completely changes, you know, the whole identity. And so I found it to be, it really ended up being a good thing for the acting.
It's part of your brand. It really is part of the Stevie Van Zandt brand. It's incredible.
Yeah, and yeah. So, you know, and it's nice. You can change that when you go to act. You know, you want to get rid of that brand and make it invisible. So, yeah, I'm able to do that.
You know, one of the things I love, and for those who haven't seen Many Saints yet, I don't want to give it away, but we do see the beginnings of the Silvio hair and why it is what it is. Did you? And obviously, Chase wrote this afterwards after Sopranos. But did you know when you were playing it the actual story of the famous hair?
No. No, I had written a biography of the character, but I did not include the famous hair. No. No. By the way, John Magaro was just terrific. You know, just terrific playing Silvio, and I'm so happy he got the role.
How long can you guys keep going, Stevie? Is this going to be like a drop till dead till I drop type thing? Like, it's pretty much I'm dropping dead on stage.
Yeah, probably. You know, I just love the fact that the Rolling Stones are still going, man. You know, because you know, as long as they're going, we're the new guys on the block. So we got, you know, we got years, you know, hopefully. Stones are rolling strong, you know, as strong as ever, really. So, you know, we're 5-6 years behind them, at least. Well, depending on where you want to start counting. I mean, age-wise, we're probably only 5 or 6 or 7 years behind them. But as far as the business, let me see, 64. Yeah, we're a good 10 years behind them, I guess. So, you know, yeah, I mean, there's no, I, you know, I don't even understand what retirement means or I don't even know what vacation means, to be honest. You know, I took a vacation once in 1978 and I didn't like it. I didn't get it. You know, I'm like, you know, if I want to go somewhere nice, I'll go somewhere nice to work.
When I was talking to Sharip earlier today, we talked all about James Gandolfini, and what a fascinating dude. Obviously, again, with many Saints, all the stories have been coming out, and the good and the bad and the demons he dealt with, but obviously the insanely incredible talent that he was. For you, who was James Gandolfini to you?
Well, he was a lot of things. For one, he was a one-man acting school. First of all, you know, like I've said 1,000 times, you do a scene with Jimmy Gandolfini, you walk away a better actor. He was extremely helpful in his attitude toward me. I was a little nervous that the actors would accept me as a peer, as a some kind of equal. As a colleague, and Jimmy immediately did so, and I think set the tone for everybody. You know, I think we bonded quite strongly off the set by him being a more natural character actor, and me being a more natural sideman. Neither one of us particularly needing the spotlight or wanting it, but both having to rise to the occasion when it was necessary and be that front man and be the star. But, you know, that was not our natural inclination. So I think we bonded on that basis of neither one of us, you know, necessarily wanting to be the boss, you know. And I think David Chase picked up on that. And that's why I ended up being that consigliere and underboss in the show, in spite of the fact that it was not that way from the beginning. I was not cast as that, you know. It was very unclear what my position was in the beginning because I wasn't part of the pilot. You know, David wrote my part in. So I at that point, I was just running the strip club for the family. And that was it. You know, there was no particular position in the family other than, you know, guy running a club. So the consigliere part happened organically and so, you know, me and Jimmy were very close off the set. Also, we were going to open a club together. We were going to open a restaurant together. He was going to be in Lilyhammer. I had a scene written for Lilyhammer, a dream sequence, which would have been fantastic. Big loss, big loss to me personally and to the industry. I think one of the great actors of all time, and he was just getting started in many ways.
So everybody always debates and hammers David Chase, and Sharippa told me he was going to hammer him again on his podcast about whether Tony died or didn't die. We'll never know. I'm sure Chase has not given up that answer. But here's the real question. When Syl wakes up out of the coma, what do you think his life is after that? Like, what do you think Syl's life is when he wakes up?
I'm glad you asked that question, because I got a script that talks about exactly that. And in fact, I wrote two different versions of the script. One that involved the other Sopranos and one that doesn't. Who knows? Someday I might use that. We'll see. David Chase read that script and really, really liked it and endorsed the idea. So one of these days, we might revisit that question.
Oh my God. I'm like, can I just get like a private read of this? I'm dying to know. If it never gets made, I might just show up at your house uninvited.
If it never gets made, I'll let you read it.
Stevie, this has been an absolute pleasure. One of my favorites, man. One last question I did want to ask you. Obviously, you were in consideration for Tony. Do you ever think about what Tony Soprano would have been had you ended up getting that role and how you would have played it?
Well, it's obviously very hard to imagine, it not being Jimmy. It's not something you can't really imagine it, because those kind of things, they become the themselves only when they happen. You would treat the character very differently. I had some eccentricities that I used with that character. It would have been a very, very different personality, and in some ways maybe more similar to my guy in Lilyhammer. I think Frankie the Fixer in Lilyhammer was probably more of what Tony Soprano, my playing Tony Soprano would have been, a little bit more open and a little bit wilder and crazier and you need those leadership sort of qualities, some of which are good, some of which are not so good, but you need a little bit of arrogance, you need a little bit of confidence, that sort of expansive sort of, I have a family to take care of here, and it's a different mentality completely. So it would change the way you walk and talk and facial expressions, and all that would be different, so you can't really imagine, Silvio suddenly becoming Tony Soprano. He would be a different guy, he'd be a different guy. And who knows? It might have worked, it might not have worked, but I'm extremely glad that they ended up with Jimmy.
Yeah, it all worked out just perfectly.
Yeah, it really did.
This has been a pleasure, man. Congratulations on the brand new book. You're one of my all-time favorites, and that show, I'll fight to the death. It's the greatest show ever made, and congrats on being part of it. And I love you and Springsteen. You guys are my childhood, so thanks so much, man.
Thank you, my friend. Good talking to you.
Great seeing you, brother. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. All right, that was Stevie Van Zandt, the one, the only, Syl in the house. Make sure to check out his brand new book. Next up, hip-hop legend, one of the greats, one of the West Coast greats, a man who's seen it all. And we talk about it during a fascinating chat here. Check it out. Here he is, Too Short. All right, we got a great day on The Endless Hustle as I'm joined by hip-hop legend and a man whose resume needs no introduction, the one and only Too Short. Too Short, welcome to the show.
What's happening? How's the audio?
Audio is good, man. Only you can make looking cool while driving, while doing a show cool. You know, I'm like, if I tried doing that, it would look so awful.
Keep your eyes on the road, man.
I love it. Hey, man, congrats on the new song you did for the Raiders. I know you did it with Cube and Neo. I want to talk to you about your love of the NFL, because with the NFL back, that's pretty much everything that anyone's talking about right now. Tell me about your love for the Raiders. How did it begin?
Well, I grew up in a house full of football fans where, you know, Sunday morning was really important. And, you know, back in the day, we didn't have the DirecTV NFL package where you get every game all day, like regardless of where it's being played. So, you know, you just you wake up, you got whatever it was, CBS, NBC, Fox, whoever was playing the game, and you just watch the games. But, you know, I'm from that era where you pick a team and you ride with your team your entire life. I think we now it seems to be people have favorite players in basketball and football, and if the player goes to a new team, then their love as a fan goes to that new team. But I'm like, I've been with the Raiders since like 1980, somewhere right around in there. And it's just, you know, that's just the team. It's the Oakland Raiders. It's just, you know, you see me in a million pictures wearing Oakland Raiders paraphernalia. You've heard it in a million songs. And I just thought that with the Raiders moving to Vegas and the Raiders having so many fans from when they were in L.A., and all the fans from Oakland and all the people in Vegas that live in Vegas who are originally from Los Angeles or the Bay Area, Oakland in particular, a lot of people live in Vegas who moved from LA or the Bay. And I just think that we needed this glue, this, you know, not like it's the magic thing that unites all the fans, but just more stuff that allows us to come into Vegas and realize that even more than the Las Vegas Raiders, even more than that, we are the Raider Nation. And they could have named the team the West Coast Raiders and it would have been acceptable. But, you know, a lot of us Raider fans we accept the name Las Vegas Raiders. You know, it's hard to say right now, but I think that when you speak of it in terms of Raider Nation, you will not get any backlash from an Oakland fan, a LA fan, or a Vegas fan. We're all Raider Nation, and that's undisputed.
You've obviously gotten to experience so many highs and so many lows as a Raiders fan, but what is your favorite game day memory?
I would have to say, I remember a game, a home game. We beat the Tennessee Titans in the playoffs. And the energy that day. But I would just have to say my best memories of home games are actually not even the game. My best memories are just tailgate parties in the Oakland Coliseum parking lot. And if you're allowed, if you're privileged enough to walk through the parking lot on a Sunday before the game, during the game, when they're tailgating, if you have that privilege of going into the parking lot and surviving, like literally like staying alive, like if you have that privilege, there's nothing to get. I've had tickets so many times. Like multiple times I had the tickets in my hand. I go into the parking lot, the food is cooking, the rowdiness is going down, the people are yelling out Raiders, and I never make it into the game. The parking lot is so much fun. I just waste my tickets and just stay out there, you know, and that's probably the best memories I have of game day is the parking lot.
I want to take you back in time. I had Cube on the show recently. And growing up, loving all of you guys, both East Coast and West Coast, just that era, there's never going to ever, ever be anything like it. Just the organicness of what was happening was just off the charts. Walk me back to that era as the, it's the East Coast versus West Coast battle. You've obviously got Pac, you've got Biggie, you've got you guys. It was something magical. What was it like living through and experiencing it?
Well, I do think that the loss of Tupac and Biggie 6 months apart from each other, I do think that signified the end of an era of hip hop that was, it's sometimes referred to as the golden era, the late 80s pushing into the early to mid 90s, the golden era of when rappers were all original, when, you know, we started, like multiple rappers started going platinum and, you know, major tours and people started getting rich and, you know, it just was a lot of success. But I think that the loss of Biggie and Tupac signified the end of that era because hip hop was in shock. The fans were in shock. I mean, it really affected a lot of fans, you know, like a lot of people just kind of went a little numb, you know? So to be a part of that, man, that era was, I think it, historically, it means a lot to me because that is a very significant era. I don't know what year in the 80s you would pick, but it would be somewhere late 80s to about, you know, I think Biggie, Pac, we lost them, and then everything kind of went bling bling and flashy, and we evolved from the bling bling to where we're at now. And you know, rap is a super mega billion dollar industry now. But right before the golden era, it was a lot of fun. It wasn't as serious. I mean, like I said, the originality was expected of you, and not to be original was frowned upon. And I think that that era will always, when you talk of hip hop, that era will always stand up on its own and be respected and just remembered, man. It was something that I think the Tupac Biggie thing was the biggest mark on that era, and I really do think it ended the era. But to be a part of it, man, was something that, you know, I look at the plaques on the wall and I look at all the collaborations I did during that time and how I was able to mix and mingle with a lot of East Coast artists at that time, as well as West Coast artists. And I know that a lot of other artists, my peers, were not allowed that privilege to be in New York making songs with Biggie during the East Coast, West Coast war. But, you know, I found a way to fit in there and not be political and not alienate anybody, and, you know, some of my proud achievements.
So Tupac is one of the most polarizing figures in music history. I mean, there's been countless hours of television, movies, docuseries detailing his life and career. And it's incredible to see the dichotomy between, here's this hyper-intelligent, ultra-artistic, just unique dude. And then he transformed as an artist and he became essentially, you know, thug life and gangster and all this whole other side you got to see of him. But to be able to know him personally, what was he actually like?
He was definitely multifaceted, and he was very interesting no matter which Tupac was on display. He was always very interesting, and if he was in a lively party mood, or, you know, just a prolific songwriter mood, or if he was, you know, in a revolutionary kind of Black Panther mentality mood, whatever it was, you got a good conversation out of him, and you got a good experience when you would come in contact with him. He was always the life of the party. He was always the spark in the room, you know, the center of attraction. Like you couldn't outshine him if he was in the same room. You just couldn't outshine him. It just was no way to do that. So every time I ever came in contact with him, good things happened. Dope songs were being made. You either witnessed something or you were a part of something.
And I think that that's another blessing of the time, was to actually be personal friends with Tupac and to work with him and to know him. It was just, you know, people ask me that question a lot, and I'm like, the only way I could tell you is that every time you would see him, if you really knew him, every time you would see him, you had to wait a few minutes to see what mood he was in, and you know, what kind of Pac was it? Because, you know, he's a Gemini, he's got like a million different personalities, and you know, he was a. I liked him the best when he just got in the studio and recorded those verses. That he used to write those verses really fucking fast, and you would think that he's writing so fast that these would have to be lyrics that he had in his mind already. But people said, no, that's just how he wrote as fast as he could think. And it was amazing, man. It was amazing to watch a guy like Biggie record without using pen and paper, and then see a guy like Tupac, you know, totally take a pen and paper and just write so fast that, like, it almost looked like scribbling. He was writing so fast. And both of them would just, the end product would just be immaculate. You know, different techniques, but great songwriters, great songwriters.
You also got to work with, in my mind, the greatest of all time, although I waver between Biggie and Jay-Z, but there's a great moment in Fade to Black, the documentary that Jay did when he was making the Black album, where he's in the studio with Timbaland, and Timbaland's like, he's the greatest because he doesn't write anything down. And you see Jay literally improvising Dirt on My Shoulder. And I'm just like, holy shit, this is crazy. Having gotten to work with all of these guys, who was the one whose talent stood out the most to you?
Well, like I said, Jay-Z and Biggie with the, you know, the immaculate rhymes without using pen and paper, and actually just, I feel like they were writing, but they were writing with like invisible ink inside your forehead, and you just memorize it in your brain. Because they wouldn't rap, like rappers now don't use pen and paper, but they rap one line at a time, or they go in the studio and they like punch me and punch me. And these guys were like memorizing the rhymes before they went in the booth, and they would spit the whole 16 or the whole thing. And it's like, that is a talent like I could never do. If I practiced my entire life, I could never do it. But they did it with ease. And I still, you know, and I'm not West Coast biased, because I feel like Tupac is partially an East Coast dude as much as he's a West Coast dude. And I just think that the way Tupac wrote those songs so fast, like you'd have to see how fast he would write. Like he's just writing words. He never stops writing. So when I write a rap, I think about it, write it, try out a couple of little different ways, you know, write it down, run it back, touch it up a little bit. This guy was just writing it down, and he said, let me in the booth. Like, dude, you just started writing 7 minutes ago. Like, how do you have a verse already? And he's like, let me in the booth. And it's just the most just timeless verse. And you're like, how do you do it? So him being able to write a song as fast as his hand could move, as fast as he could think it, to me was very skillful. So I, being a songwriter myself, I think back on the times I was in the studio with him, and I'm like, that's kind of genius to be able to come up with rhymes as fast as you can think, as fast as your hand can write, and then not just some bullshit you wrote, but really like some shit that we want to hear. So I work with a lot of good songwriters, a lot of dudes, a lot of techniques, a lot of E-40s and Scarface and Eric Sermon, and a lot of people that just instantly do dope shit in the studio. But I got to give that to Tupac, just on that technique I described to you.
So you just formed this super group. Obviously, it's you, Snoop, Cube. I mean, just to see you guys getting back together, I love it. Talk to me about that friendship, now being essentially middle-aged men, and then you look back on the young guys that you were. How crazy is it to think that, A, you're still doing what you're doing, and B, what do all of you guys think as you look back on those young men?
We think that we made some good moves in life to where we actually survived, you know, the rat race. We survived the hip hop game, and so many people that are from our original era got parked, and you know, they're not really active anymore. And individually, each of us has maintained our relevancy through social media, through music, through movies, through television, through, you know, just basically being larger than life images. And the hustle is intact. It's like without each other, you're doing just fine. But together, if you get that Voltron effect to where easy mathematics, if you do a concert and you're a promoter and you do a and your bill has four artists on the bill, and those four artists are Too Short, Ice Cube, E-40, and Snoop Dogg, and you do this show at a huge arena, a show's gonna sell out. We do the show all the time. We've done it over the years, in the last 5, 6, 7 years, a lot. And regardless of how you make this show happen, we decided let's control the narrative and let's start a super group to where they can't call our managers and hire us individually. They got to call us and hire us as one. And you know, going into this, you call it middle age, I call it senior citizens, because we're all in the 50s. Going into that phase in our lives and having control of how you get paid or how much you get paid or you know, just literally just being able to charge top dollar. Like, you got to pay us more together than you do individually. So I think this was a genius move. It wasn't my idea, but when it was described to me, I'm like, I'm all the way in with this. This is how you take four OG rappers and convert them into the Motown Review. The fucking, you know, I look at it like when the Four Tops and the Temptations and Diana Ross and the Supremes and Smokey Robinson and the Miracles and they fucking 60 something years old and they go to fucking Europe and the fucking tour sells out everywhere. And every time you see the Motown Review, it's just as high as it was in 1967. I look at it like that, man. I think that we're in that phase of our career where I could do shows by myself all day, but when I do shows with those guys, everything is bigger, everything is better. So to be smart enough to join forces, and we call it Voltron, the Voltron factor. Like, we all just Voltron up and just become one big fucking monster.
So obviously Versus and the phenomenon that it's become has reignited so many people's remembrance of generational music and artists. And obviously people's memory goes quick, right? Like, people forget how legendary someone like you or Snoop or Dre or a million others are. And Versus has helped bring that to the forefront by showcasing the legends of music against each other. Recently, Jermaine Dupri said that he wanted to go up against Diddy, and Diddy like literally was like, fuck off. Like, you couldn't hang with me. And Diddy said the only person that could really hang with him is Dre. So I want to ask you, as someone who's gotten to see both in their primes, who do you think wins in a Versus battle, Diddy or Dre?
First of all, it would take some extracurricular activities, some secret sauce to even get Puff Daddy past Jermaine Dupri. Because if we talk about hits, like, you can, Jermaine Dupri has hits that he doesn't really have visual credit for. Like, there's no Jermaine video for every fucking hit he made, because it's like big artists that he doesn't need to be in the video dancing and shit. So even if he has a cameo or not, It's still Jermaine Dupri production. So I don't know, man. You can't just dismiss JD and say I got more hits than JD, because I don't know. That's an underestimation I would not want to be on the wrong end of. But I don't think there's any individual that could go up against the original Eazy-E catalog, NWA catalog, Death Row's catalog, Eminem's catalog, 50 Cent's catalog, and so much more. As an artist, the two Chronic albums, the Snoop Doggy Dogg album, I don't think anybody as a producer can just battle that shit and say, like, bring Dr. Dre on. Like, who's that guy? Who's that guy? And then again, you know, Puffy is, we're talking music, man. I make music, talking about people I know and love. Puffy's not the one in the studio banging on the drum machine and twisting the knobs. He's the one in the studio making these records a hit. He's making them hits because he has that ear and that vibe to know that's not a hit. It's a hot record, but it's not a hit. Make it a hit. So they keep working. Or, you know, I seen him. He's definitely the motivating factor in the studio. And he's definitely important, because people who work with him make hit records. And then when they're not with him anymore, they can't make a hit. So that shows you his value. But how are you going to battle these producers if you're not a producer? I don't know, you know? I don't know how that works, but I do know for the showmanship. Okay, we can't kick Puffy out the car, because he's gonna make the show better than me, you, anybody else. He's the best. He throws the best parties. He does, you know. He has a great track record, but.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I was thinking about, if you were to think who's the GOAT of verses, there's a solid argument that you could say Dre's the GOAT, because you're right. His catalog and his breadth and his longevity and the artists. I mean, obviously, Puff brings Biggie and Mary J, and he mentioned that against JD, but you're right. Dre brings NWA, Snoop, Eminem, his own albums, and you're just like, holy shit, it's like never ending.
What's the battle, though? The battle is producers, or the battle is labels? What's the battle?
So essentially, I think it's loosely defined, but I think it's, if you had any involvement in either producing or performing on a song, you can count that as your song. So, you know, with Puff, he was mentioning Faith Evans and obviously Biggie and Mary J, but Dre brings both ends of the table and so many artists. I was literally thinking, is there anyone who could beat Dre? I'm not sure there is. Like, I guess you can probably figure out like Clive Davis or like Quincy Jones or somebody, you know, like.
Yeah, you gotta go there. Exactly. You gotta leave our era and go to another era. You gotta cross genres to get with Dre.
What do you think of rap today, Short? Like, are you a fan of what we're seeing now?
I love it. I think the process of making a hit record did not become easier or you know. Or less quality. It's a hit's a hit. Shit. What era in music do you want to go to in hit making? You want to talk about gospel? You want to talk about jazz in its young youthful days? You want to talk about swing bands? I mean, what the fuck do you want to talk about? Rock and roll from the 60s? What do you want to talk about? Because I think making a hit record is a magical thing, and you can try all you want. You can go in there, you can be a hit maker and try all you want to keep making hits. It's hard as fuck. So when a young artist makes a hit, give a young artist credit for making a hit, because you can't, your criteria that you saying what a hit is not necessarily what a fan thinks. You saying that a hit is a record, oh, you got to say these words and you got to do like this and the beat. Fuck that shit. The hit is the one that goes up the charts and takes over the airwaves and takes over the motherfucking scene. So if Young Thug is the hit maker, you can't discount him. You can't discount his hits by saying his lyrics ain't like Nas's lyrics. That's bullshit. That's bullshit. So a hit's a hit. So I think our artists right now, our young artists right now, definitely know how to make hit records. They definitely are in a position where they're making more money than us because they have more platforms to not only present their music, but they have more platforms to make money off of so many different things, off of popularity. You get fucking rich off of popularity. So I admire them. I think part of our hatred, and I'm not saying R as in mine, but part of our generation's hatred for young rap is the fact that they make so much fucking money so easily, and so much money off just like maybe one hot song or just one hot year. And we're like, you whack, you can't rap like Nas. You don't deserve to have that. Says who? Shit. Like, the rappers that came before me did not have the opportunity to go on sold out tours. And I'm selling my car if you're wondering what I'm doing. I'm actually...
Dude, by the way, I was going to say, I've interviewed everybody on the planet on the show. I feel like I've spent a day with you right now, and I'm literally like trying to figure out.
The coming to get it. We're selling the car. The tow truck's coming to get it. So
I'm like dying inside. I'm like, I literally feel like I spent a day with Too Short at the moment.
Yep. I'm about to get back in the car and bust a move. I just had to position that thing for the pickup.
That's amazing. I mean, as you were putting stuff in your sax bag, I'm like trying to figure out what is he putting in there. It sounded like change, and I was dying. As I'm balancing the conversation, I'm dissecting your life simultaneously.
Yep, I took out all the things that you acquire in a car over a 3-year period and put them in a Saks Fifth Ave bag. And I will go through that later and organize that later. Now I got to get back on the road.
It's incredible stuff, man. It's funny because the one thing I will argue, I agree with you, making a hit's making a hit. The one thing I will argue was there was an originality to all of you guys and girls. Like when Lil' Kim came on the scene, or Biggie and Pac, or you and E-40, there was something so authentic about it that we got to experience the come up with you guys. Where today it feels much more manufactured, and they're billion-dollar brand. From 12 years old on, but you guys, it really felt like we were watching one of us make it, and we got to see you in the raw element.
I do have to remind you of one thing that you can't forget. At every point in time, every period in hip hop, we have had an enormous amount of terrible music trying to be released, terrible artists with terrible looks and terrible songs, and we've had greatness in every era, like an overabundance of it. And you can't fucking just say they're not doing it now. We have some very prolific wordsmith in hip hop right now. And it's just a lot of stuff that you want to call this mumble rap, or, you know, just you want to discount it is how I feel. And I think, you know, what's the difference between a mumble rapper and Daz FX? I don't know. What's the difference? Shit, I can take you back to a lot of my songs that are just basic ass, you know, songs that just have a good vibe. It's not really about the wordplay. It's more about the funny part or the bass in the song than it is about clever rhymes and phrases. And if I can get you back on the Bluetooth. Whack rappers have always been around, man. They always will be around. Whack songs and dope songs. And I mean, shit, it's just like the NBA, man. You're talking about who's the GOAT of all eras. You would never know till you put a grown-ass man and take a grown man and transport him from 2021 to 1976 and see if he can hang with Dr. J. I don't know.
Bro, this was just amazing. I can't tell you. This was actually one of the funniest ones, but you're just an awesome, your knowledge is amazing, man. And just hearing, this is the era I grew up in. So I always, even when I had Cube on the show, you know, just hearing what you guys went through and your opinions, it's just, it's amazing to me, man. It's like these youngins will never understand.
They don't have to. They're in their own era, and they need to just make the most out of what's been given to them and kind of just ignore any negative energy that's telling them that they're not talented. Just do what you do, you know? So I'm a firm believer in hot songs, man. I love a hot song. And I was criticized a lot as a youngster for not being a good rapper. And then I changed that narrative to being, oh, he's from California. Oh, he's from the Bay. Oh, he's whack. He can't really rhyme. He's just cursed. I changed that narrative to he's a fucking legend. And I changed that narrative by consistently making good music, consistently being on the charts, multiple platinum albums, gold albums, multiple platinum and gold features, and hits that are strung apart 10, 20, 30 years apart. And then once I put that out there, you can't call me a whack rapper for life. It's something that I did that makes me not whack. So, you know, I changed the narrative. Not just that. All of our artists right now who are presently starting careers and who are in young careers, I think they all have that opportunity to do what Chris Brown is doing. Chris Brown was literally, you know, hung out to dry, and they attempted to throw him away more than once. And the only thing, because he doesn't have really great PR, he's not really, you know, trying to kiss the industry's ass. He's only doing one thing. He's making a lot of good fucking music. And you can say anything about Chris Brown right now, but you can't say that he doesn't make hits. And you can't say that he doesn't make a lot of hits. And you can't say that he's a whack artist. You can't say any of that because he's controlling that narrative. So we fast forward. Chris Brown might be 10, 15 years into his career. Let's fast forward another 10, 15 and put him where I'm at. How many hits does this guy have? You know, so let them all tell their stories, man. We'll see. I'm more concerned with the violence in hip hop, how real famous popular artists are getting murdered or just shot up or, you know, attempted murders and getting arrested for murder. And it's like, that ain't what this is supposed to be. You're not supposed to get to your point in life like XXX and you like all of a sudden 19, 20 years old, Pop Smoke, money's about to come in. It's just your moment and they just cut you down. You just get murdered. This is not the way it's supposed to be.
I agree, man. Dude, this has been an awesome chat. Thank you so much, Too Short. And the new song is Raider Colors. You, Neo, and Ice Cube supporting your squad. Thanks for a fun chat, man.
Hi, man.
Take care, brother. Good luck with the car.
All righty.
All right, folks. That was, of course, Too Short. Make sure to check out all the projects we talked about during that conversation. One of the greats as a hip-hop head myself, anytime I get legends like this on the show, it's always an absolute dynamite pleasure. All right, as always, that's another great episode of Endless Hustle in the books. We've got two dynamite episodes next week. In the meantime, make sure to subscribe, rate, watch, listen. You know the deal. We're everywhere. Follow us on social media. On Twitter, we are at @endless_hustle. On Instagram, at @endlesshustlepod. Me personally, I'm at Arthur Cade. On Twitter, at @itsmearthurcade. On Instagram. And we'll be back next week. Again, happy Thanksgiving. If you're listening to this or watching this during your Thanksgiving holiday, happy and healthy one to you and your family. Thanks as always for endlessly hustling with us. We'll see y'all next Tuesday. Have a great holiday. Later.